You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. California in the late 1960s was seen as a mecca for the counterculture revolution, a haven of peace, tranquility, and community. Yet darkness lurked in the shadows, as one series of murders became linked to an individual who became known as the Zodiac Killer. Now considered one of America's most intriguing unsolved murder cases, this case has continued to fascinate people from around the globe to this very day. Joining me to look at this case, and a particularly overlooked potential suspect, is author Drew Reason. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support Mysteries and Monsters with your contributions. It means a great deal. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Our intro and outro music are provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Let's join author Drew Beeson as we dive into his book, Sighting In on the Zodiac Killer, Unmasking America's Most Puzzling Unsolved Murders. In the modern era, some mysteries continue to intrigue and puzzle people long after the alleged case has concluded. When we consider some of the most notorious of unsolved cases, one still has the power to captivate and shock us, that of the Zodiac Killer. With 5 murders attributed to him, the case continues to attract serious attention and investigation, even after over 55 years from that first murder. Joining me to discuss this and much more is author Drew Hurst Beeson, author of Sighting In on the Zodiac Killer. Drew, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Thank you, Paul. Glad to be here.
My absolute pleasure, Drew. This is probably one of those cases that I can't tell you, Drew, when it first crossed my radar. I've always been interested in strange things, a lot to do with the Fortean realm and the paranormal more often than not, but I also have a real interest in certain unsolved notorious serial killer cases such as this. For you, Drew, you've kind of gravitated towards strange cases and unsolved mysteries throughout. So what's your germination in regards to what fired you up and got you interested in looking into some of these cases? Were you somebody that always had a love of the weird and the strange as a child growing up, or is it something you developed an interest in later in life?
I think I developed it a little later in life. There was a well-known TV show here over in the States called Unsolved Mysteries, hosted by a former actor named Robert Stack, and it was just a great TV show. I mean, that it delved into some unknown cold cases and then some very popular ones like DB Cooper. I don't think they ever did a show on Zodiac, but it was such a great TV show, and I think that's what inspired me and a lot of others to dive into some of these classic, what I call American cold cases, DB Cooper, Zodiac Killer, things along those lines. But you know what's interesting about the Zodiac is there's so many things that the Zodiac Killer was appeared to be really fascinated with, a lot of things that came out of England, which is just an interesting tie into this case. And a lot of people in Great Britain are fascinated by this case. And the world's top expert on the case actually lives in England. His name is Richard Grinnell, has a website called ZodiacCiphers.com. So I've always enjoyed the fact that people across the pond have had such a huge interest in the Zodiac case.
I've found it incredible, even after all this time, Drew, just how many times I will see a news paper report or an interview or an article that someone's solved the case again. And I think that there is something about this whole series of murders that occurred in the San Francisco Bay Area back in the late 60s that even now people just can't seem to leave this case alone regardless. And I think for you, this wasn't your sort of first foray into investigation, as you mentioned there, another one of the most famous unsolved mysteries is obviously D.B. Cooper. So
Were you prepared, Drew, for entering into the world of the Zodiac? Because to say this, there is a fevered and passionate crowd that have been looking into this case for a long time, who have some very cast iron ideas about who, what and when this all entails. Were you a little surprised, even though you knew a bit about it when you took your first forays into looking into the Zodiac?
Oh, I was. It was a little more contentious than I thought it would be. A lot of people are, like you said, dead set in their theories and their ideas. That, you know, there was a large online community of Zodiac killer researchers, and it was pretty rough and tumble. But I kind of stayed away from that for a good amount of time until things started catching up with me. Particularly one researcher that I won't name. Things got pretty contentious there for a while, and there was a pretty public feud going on. But, you know, by and large, I've stayed away from it. And a lot of us researchers in the case are actually pretty good friends, and we communicate. I mentioned Richard Grinnell, a top researcher, probably knows more about the case than anyone in the world individually. I stay in touch with Richard. He's very open with his research and ideas. Another guy named Ned DeHaan has a channel called Black Box Online Radio, good friend of mine. So a lot of us stay in touch, and I'd say for the most part, we're actually pretty good friends.
Do you think that has helped in regards to this? Because it's allowed, because what I've noticed is, especially in regards to this one, there seems to be a lot of cross-pollination that goes on, Drew, between researchers and investigators in this particular case.
There is. There's quite a bit. And it helps a lot, you know, just to stay in touch with them, what they know, who they talk to, what they're thinking, what their theories are. And I've got good friends that have completely different theories than my own. Thomas Henry Horan is one of them, who has the Zodiac hoax theory, a pretty controversial theory, but he's a good friend of mine. He actually got me on a major TV show. So it's good to you know, not dismiss anybody just because you disagree with them. It's good to just see their point of view and for, you know, the good points that it has and find some common ground, which I think a lot of us have.
Well, strangely enough, that was shown over here recently. I think it was on last year, Thomas Horan's show, working on the theories that he was putting forward about it all being a big hoax and there was no real single perpetrator, and looking essentially that these were individual crimes that have been lumped together for some reason. And obviously you appeared as one of the people involved in that, along with some other well-known Zodiac researchers.
Yeah, Michael Butterfield was in it. A real long-time well-known Zodiac killer researcher. He was in it, and really good cast we had for that show. And I think it did really well.
Do you think it was needed, especially after what's happened with the whole Gary Stewart situation, which I found, I was really taken aback both by the whole premise of what that was purportedly the real Zodiac story, Drew, in regards to how that was filmed. Because I think sometimes when we have true life documentaries done, sometimes they will play hard and fast with the reality of certain things. And yet what struck me about that was, essentially, we had a case built through, I think, three episodes. And then the fourth episode was essentially deconstructing it all and really sort of peeling it back and saying, there's not much here to this.
There was almost nothing to it. And it, what was, you know, you have this happens to D.B. Cooper, too. So you're talking about Gary Stewart, who felt that his father, Earl Van Best Jr., was the Zodiac killer. And he manages to somehow get a good co-writer, actually, she wrote most of his book. I think her name was Susan Mustafa, which is a really, really good writer, and just got some good media behind it. You know, he has a pretty good day job, as I'll call it. So he had some money behind him, able to pay some people up front. He got a major publisher to take that book on. That's why he got so much media. And to the layperson, they're thinking, you know, when they first see these interviews, they're like, oh, this guy's got something here. But the people that really know the case, that have studied it for years, he was never a good suspect to anybody like me that's been into the case for years. Even people that are students of it that never really push a suspect per se, like Richard Grinnell, he just never got any traction whatsoever. But these shows will go with whatever they think is going to get people to tune in the most, you know, something that's shocking or something that, you know, a piece of footage. And here they have a guy that claims to have been the son, so that's interesting to them. But the people that do these TV shows really don't care who the Zodiac killer was. They just want to, you know, build up the media behind it and get a lot of people to tune in. And they were successful in that. Actually, he sold quite a few books. with all the media he had behind him, and getting, you know, they book him on TV shows on CNN, but, you know, he's talking to people who don't know the case. He's talking to, you know, an audience that don't really understand the basics of it. So to them, it sounds, you know, wonderful. But in reality, he's probably at the bottom of the stack of viable suspects in the opinion of most researchers.
Hmm. Do you think this is one of the big problems about the whole Zodiac? Not only have we got such a length of time from the alleged final, because people still, very similarly to the Jack the Ripper cases, Drew, there are some people who think there are far more than five murders that we can attribute to this particular character. There are some people who say they're not even convinced that the five are there. There are so many layers and theories put forward in regards to this that I find somebody like Gary Stewart's wanting to insert himself so much into this. The whole thing struck me as a rather sad tale more than anything. It seemed like there was a lot of issues under the surface here that I didn't understand why someone would want their father to be the Zodiac.
That's one thing that's strange about it, and I think that was part of the allure, because part of his relationship with his father was fairly intriguing. He was involved in something, I think, called the ice cream murder or something. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, his father was an interesting person. You know, there's no doubt. And he had never really knew him, didn't grow up with him. But his, you know, learning about his father was pretty traumatic, and what he learned about him. And then part of the show, it's where he visits his grave. I think he was buried in Mexico, oddly enough. And so, you know, some of that was compelling, but I think he felt like he had to tie his father into being the Zodiac killer just to get a little more publicity. We've seen this play out before with some other people have suspects that was also, they believed it was her father or maybe an uncle. And when those cases come out, people are already kind of dismissive of them. But the, you know, the joke is that the case gets solved five times a month or something like that. You know, and now we have this, suspect called Gary Francis Post, which has gotten a lot of media.
Yes.
And he's very similar to Earl Van Best Jr., where he's just a terrible suspect. There's no suspect substance to him at all. It's just he's being backed by a group led by a guy named Thomas Colbert, who's the former TV producer, has a lot of media contacts. So he's able to get his theory out there to a mass group. A lot of the papers in UK cover stuff like that, like The Sun or The Daily Mail likes a lot of articles like that. And they have contacts at these online places to get a lot of views. So a lay person would say, I heard it was solved. It was this guy named Gary Post or something like that. And of course, we just laugh it off. You know, there's nothing going for a guy like that. But it's always the people that get the most media behind them have the worst suspects. It's just kind of the way it goes in Zodiac land.
So would you suggest that, I mean, the thing that I'm always struck by still is that for a lot of people, as you say, Drew, a lot of lay people who have a passing interest in this particular thing, they would tend to think that there's one prime suspect more than any other, which is Arthur Lee Allen, who is a very intriguing person, shall we say, who seemed a very odd person in general anyway. And obviously, I know Dave Toschke thought he was the key person. He thought there was a lot of evidence and the way he carried himself and his gut feeling. For him, it seemed a done deal, really. But obviously, they couldn't find anything sort of concrete. But do you think that's still surprising when we've got so many other people that are bouncing around underneath Allen in regards to who people would consider a viable suspect, Drew?
I think Allen is still the prime suspect in the case because the circumstantial evidence for him is still the strongest. Even though, a movie was written about Robert Graysmith's book, Zodiac, which is about Arthur Lee Allen being the Zodiac killer, was made into a major motion picture by a director named David Fincher, who made a lot of big films. It came out in 2007. Mm-hmm. And Robert Graysmith took a lot of liberties. He basically made up some things that weren't true. But now we've had all these years since the movie came out and the book's been out for a long, long time. I think at least 20 years, more, maybe I think longer. We've had all the opportunity in the world to kind of figure out what was true and what was not true. And even when you strip away all the things that were either not true or embellished by Robert Graysmith, Allen still stands way ahead of the pack in regards to all these other new specs that come up, that even promising ones like Paul Doerr, it's pretty good. He still is head and shoulders circumstantially above any other suspect. And this is a circumstantial case. There is no DNA from the case, despite what a lot of people believe. there is really no physical evidence to tie to. So, you know, we're all these suspects are just circumstantial, submissions on who it could be.
Do you think when you started to collate your theories and looking at how you brought forward what you believe in regards to being an excellent candidate for this particular case, I think I wasn't really that aware of Don Cheney. But as I've heard you say previously, Drew, he's hiding in plain sight through a lot of this, because wasn't Cheney the kind of the person that was putting Alan forward as the Zodiac? And a lot of the sort of context in regards to why Alan became such a suspect was down to Cheney kind of pointing the finger at him repeatedly.
It was all Don Cheney is the reason why we have Arthur Lee Allen as a prime suspect. So Don Cheney comes forward in July of 1971 with his accusations about his friend Arthur Lee Allen being the Zodiac killer. So here's somebody that's been involved since July of 1971. The last canonical Zodiac murder was in October of 1969, the murder of cab driver Paul Stein. So we're not that far removed between when John Cheney comes forward with this information and the final known murder of the Zodiac killer at Presidio Heights. So that's how far back he goes. So he forever changed this case when he did that, because like you said, you mentioned Dave Toski, that was the head investigator at San Francisco Police Department, firmly believed Arthur Lee Allen was the Zodiac and there was no better suspect. Many in law enforcement for the different municipalities that were involved in the case believed it was Arthur Lee Allen that was responsible for these crimes. So when Don Cheney came forward, he forever changed the landscape of this case. And that's what enabled Robert Graysmith to have a best-selling book that became a major motion picture in 2007. So without Don Cheney, we're not looking at the same case in terms of popularity, because Allen was such a well-regarded suspect that it forever changed everything people know about this case. So that's the most intriguing thing about it is he had been around since July of 71. And by doing so, he inserted himself into the case, which some criminals do. That's been known to happen in certain crimes where the killer will come forward as somebody that's going to help you solve it. But they're actually the person that's responsible for it, but they want to get closer to it. They want to revel in what they did. This is something similar to the BTK killer did that when he was kind of taking a victory lap. He mailed in some correspondence to the police. His name was Dennis Rader. And the police looked at some of the material he sent, and they were able to take a computer disk. And he thought he deleted some files, but they were able to save a letter that he wrote as a head of a church group that he was involved in. So that's how he eventually got caught, by inserting himself. Like, he wanted attention for what he did. So that was his actual unraveling. So Don Cheney's the only person that clearly inserted himself into this case when he came forward claiming his friend was the Zodiac. And what was interesting about that is Don Cheney claimed on New Year's Day of 1968, he later moves this date to New Year's Day 1969, which is very interesting. It was his Achilles heel, in my opinion, and what really put him on my map is him having to change that timeline. But he said that on New Year's Day, Arthur Lee Allen told him that he was going to go kill couples on Lover's Lanes. He was going to call himself the Zodiac. And Don suggested, oh, I would pick a better name, this whole thing. He said that Allen took him around to a couple of the attack sites, one being Lake Herman Road, where the first canonical Zodiac attack happened in December of 1968. And then he took him to Blue Rock Springs Park, which was the second known Zodiac attack on July 4th, 1969 in Vallejo, California. So if Don Cheney's telling the truth, Arthur Lee Allen has to be the Zodiac, because he told him he was going to be the Zodiac. He told him beforehand when these crimes were going to happen. So the interesting thing is why would it take Don Cheney a minimum of a year and a half to come forward about what his friend told him that day? You think he would have told people the day it happened? He would have told his brother. Arthur Lee Allen's younger brother was Ronald Allen. That's actually how Don Cheney met Arthur Lee Allen. He met his younger brother first, going to college at Cal Poly Pomona in Southern California. So Don had a great relationship. Don was actually really close friends with Ron Allen before striking up a good friendship with Arthur Lee Allen, the older brother. So Don doesn't tell anybody about this stuff and somehow manages not to hear anything about this case until he reads about something called the Grass Valley murders that happened in Northern California. And something in that jars Don's memory about Arthur Lee Allen telling him how he's going to be the Zodiac. And then Don reads a letter in the newspaper that the Zodiac killer wrote, talking about picking off the little kiddies as they come bouncing off a school bus, which was, one of the Zodiac killer's biggest threats. And that totally alarmed the whole city of San Francisco. Police were following buses to school. Everyone was on high alert, but that Don Chaney said when he read that line by the Zodiac in the paper that he recalled that Arthur Lee Allen said something similar about picking the kiddies off. And that's what led to him eventually coming forward about his friend and these memories about what he told him on that New Year's Day. So, the timing is already very suspect how Don Chaney could be living in California. And it took that long for something to jar his mind about his friend telling him all this stuff, because the case was already all over national news, much less, Don Chaney was living in Southern California at the time, but it was on every front page of the newspapers when it all happened. And somehow none of that was able to jar Don Chaney's memory. But it takes a separate crime to finally get him going to where he comes forward in July of 1971. Which is the first thing that, to me, that was very odd in Don's behavior.
I mean, the thing about this whole scenario as well, as we've touched on, Drew, there are five murders that most people are very happy to say were definitely that. So for anybody who's not that well versed in this particular case, what are the five cases that essentially people consider the Zodiac to be the perpetrator for? Who were they, and what's so striking about them that it still shocks people? I know the late Berryessa one, for me personally, Drew, is probably the most frightening out of all of them, in my opinion.
I agree, absolutely. So there was five murders. There was actually five people that were killed by the Zodiac in what we call four canonical crimes. The first was at Lake Herman Road. That happened on December 20th of 1968. A young couple was out on their first date, David Arthur Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen. She was 17, he was 18. They were parked on this, just basically a turnout on a cut through road from Benicia, California over to Vallejo. And then basically, pitch black at night, they had gone to a Christmas concert at, I think it was at Betty Lou's high school, it was Hogan High School. David actually went to Vallejo High. And after the concert, they may or may not have stopped and gotten something to eat. And then they eventually go over to this lover's lane to talk, kiss, whatever, young people do. But it was a first date, and it was, I think it was somewhere around 10 p.m. or so. They're just sitting in the car talking, and a man walks up with a gun, and we believe he orders David Faraday out of the car. He refuses. The man shoots into the car. David Faraday shoots him in the side of the head. Betty Lou gets out of the car. She starts to run. This man proceeds to shoot her in the back. She pretty much dies instantly. It takes David a little longer to pass away, but he kills both of those victims. Those were the Zodiac killer's first two victims, because they did both die. And then he goes silent until July 4th of 1969. So we're talking about, a good 5 months later. Actually 6 months later, he approaches another couple in a parked car. It's Darlene Farron and a guy named Michael Mugeot, who she was good friends with. She was married at the time, but she dated quite a bit, even though she was married. But she was with Michael Mugeot, parked at a place called Brewart Springs Park. A car comes up behind them, headlights on, and they think this is going to be the police, because right before midnight on July 4th, there's fireworks going off, and the man gets out of his car holding a flashlight. Interestingly, he walks over to the passenger side of the car where Michael is sitting, and Darlene's behind the steering wheel, and the man starts firing into the car, shooting. One bullet goes through Michael, hits Darlene. Probably it was enough to kill her, but a couple more bullets hit her. She's going to pass away on the way to the hospital after this attack. Michael's hit two or three times. He winds up, and he's in a lot of pain. He winds up thrashing around and kind of throwing himself into the back seat of the car. The man walks back to his vehicle and hears Michael still groaning in pain. So he walks back from his car and fires a couple more rounds into Michael Mugeot. interestingly, Michael Mugeot winds up surviving that her, you know, heinous attack, and is able to give somewhat of a description of his attacker. Even though he had a flashlight in his face, he said the guy was of a stocky build. He thought he was around 5'8". It was a white male. So this is the first description of all we get of the Zodiac killer is from Michael Mugeot, because he survives. Although he was shot up pretty bad, he survives that attack. Not long after, the third attack that you mentioned was at Lake Berryessa. It's a recreational lake over by Napa. And a couple it's in the afternoon. It was Brian Hart and Ellen Cecilia Shepherd. They used to date each other, and they had ran into each other, I think, the previous day. And they wanted to go spend some time together. They were going to go drive into the city of San Francisco, but they realized it was going to take a little too long because Brian had a commitment later that night. So they wind up going for a little picnic over on the shore of Lake Berryessa at a place called Double Oak Ridge, which is kind of a peninsula at that time of year. So they walk down to it. This is still a sunny day. It's daylight, which is, makes this attack totally different than the first two, which happened at night, of course. And they lay out a blanket. They're talking for a while, and Brian suddenly, in conversation, notices Cecilia is distracted. And he doesn't know why. And he's like, why aren't you paying attention to me? And she goes, because I see a man over there. And she looks across maybe about 100 yards or so. There's a man by a tree. And at this point, she can see that he's not wearing anything like a costume yet, but it's too far away to really tell what he looks like. She just thought it was odd that he was kind of looking at them, and then he would go back to hiding behind this tree. So she kind of just wrote it off, and they start talking again. And then she looks up, you know, very surprised, and she sees that the man she just saw is walking towards them very briskly. And at that point, he's got this hood over his head that looks like an executioner's hood. It's black. He's got what looks like clip-on sunglasses, so you can't see his face at all because his head's totally covered. This costume covers up part of his chest, which we later find out had the symbol of the Zodiac drawn on it, what we call the cross circle logo. It's a circle with a X going through it, which is, that's the Zodiac's trademark. And he walks up to them. He's got a gun in his right hand, and obviously they're very frightened. They don't know what's going on. And he immediately wants to put them, it's somewhat ease. And he says, don't worry. All I want is your money and your car keys. So they think, okay, we're just going to get robbed. We'll give him what we have and he'll go away. So Brian offers him some change. He didn't have any significant money on him. He had just had a pocket of change, and he said, hey, I just have this change on me, but you're welcome to it. And they think he's just gonna go. He offers him his car keys, and the man gets all this, and he doesn't seem interested in it anymore. He said, what I'm gonna need to do is tie you both up. And at that point, Brian knew this was a little more than just a quick robbery. And all the time, Brian's trying to engage this man in conversation just to get him to calm down, learn a little more about him, but he's only saying certain things to Brian. So they knew it was going to be bad if he had tied him up. So he has Cecilia tie Brian up, and I think he winds up tying up Cecilia, and then the attacker goes in there and tightens up the knots on both of them. And then he proceeds to stab. He takes out a foot-long knife, had a foot-long blade on it that was, you know, a sheath on his left hip. He takes the knife out, and he begins to stab Brian Hartnell in the back. And then Brian is not killed. He's still alive, and he's playing dead. And then the man goes over and starts stabbing Cecilia in the back. And she's moaning in pain, thrashing around. It's very, very violent. And she's not killed instantly. She would actually pass away 2 days later from her wounds. So Brian and Cecilia are able to give a description of their attacker. After he stabs both of them, he just calmly walks away. After this violent attack, doesn't say anything else. He just walks off into the distance. So they're there laying. They're wounded. They're both bleeding very badly. Some people drive by in boats on there, and they're trying to wave people down for help. Eventually, a boater did see them and reported that they were there. Brian winds up crawling towards the road a very long distance. Although he's wounded, he's bleeding out, and he's eventually picked up by a park ranger named Dennis Land. Cecilia, all the police from Napa finally show up, and they're able to interview Cecilia about what she saw. She gives a description of the attacker. She said he's around 6 foot tall. He was wearing this black hood they both described, and she described seeing brown hair coming through the eyelets of the mask. It was long enough the hair was long enough to come through the eyelid of the mask down past the sunglasses. And Brian said the same thing. Yes, I saw that too. Brown hair coming through the eyelids of the mask, which I think is a critical point in his description that they both noted. Cecilia, like I said, passed away at the Queen of Valley Hospital 2 days later. Brian recovers from his wounds, and Brian's the reason that we know that he was wearing that outfit. We don't know why he was wearing it. We think it meant something to him. He never said, I'm the Zodiac. He never said any of that. He just said, I'm here to rob you, and never did rob him. He winds up stabbing them both. And that's the story of Lake Berryessa. And I agree. It's a departure from the first two attacks. And it's very strange. He's wearing that outfit. We don't know if he was wearing something like that at Lake Herman Road, because neither Betty Lou or David were able to give a description, but he was not wearing that at the attack at Blue Rock Springs. So the following October 11, 1969, a cab driver named Paul Stein picks up a fare in San Francisco at the corner of Mason and Gary. The man gets in the car. He says he wants to go to Washington Cherry Street over in the Presidio Heights, very wealthy neighborhood in San Francisco. The car pulls up near that intersection, and the man riding in the back seat of the cab pulls out a 9mm handgun, and he shoots Paul Stein right above his right ear and basically kills him instantly. And this is seen by some kids across the street. Their name's the Robins, and they get a description of the man through the second story window, and they said he was wiping down the cab after this attack. The police were initially looking after this crime for a black male, and of course it was a white male, so we don't know why that happened, but some police were out looking for the attacker of Paul Stein, and they actually drove up on the Zodiac killer. An officer named Donald Falk with his partner Eric Zelms saw the man, but they didn't think much of it because they're looking for a black male, not a white male. So they were, in retrospect, did see the Zodiac killer and were able to give a description as well. But the infamous sketch of the Zodiac killer comes from that sighting at the Presidio Heights by the kids across the street. The eldest of the kids was a guy named Lindsay Robbins, and he gave a description, and that's what the police built that famous sketch from. Donald Falk later looked at it and said, yeah, this is pretty accurate, but he looked a little bit different, and they amended this sketch some, but that's where that sketch comes from. And that was the final attack of the Zodiac killer in Presidio Heights, and they knew that was a Zodiac crime because days after the attack on Paul Stein, someone had mailed in a letter, because Zodiac was known for mailing letters in. It contained a piece of Paul Stein's bloody shirt, because after he was shot, the Zodiac tore a square section of Paul Stein's shirt from the tailpiece in the back. And he mailed in three correspondences that had a piece of Paul Stein's bloody shirt. So it was conclusive that whoever did this, claiming to be the Zodiac, actually did the crime, because he had a physical piece of evidence that was mailed in with the letter, which is the most important thing about the Paul Stein shooting, is that the killer wanted people to know it was Zodiac, and he proved it by containing that piece of bloody shirt.
I think this is one of the things that sometimes causes people to think this is not the same person, and yet we know that Stein is clearly that, because obviously he once again bragged about what he'd done, Drew. I mean, the thing about these particular cases is obviously the first two murders or murder events are both shootings. The third one's a stabbing. And then then he goes back to a shooting again. Do you think this is one of the reasons why people are so intrigued by this? Because often when you have a killer or a serial murderer of these types, they tend to start in this particular way. And you can see sometimes that certain people will change their modus operandi, or they'll try and mix it up a bit. Whereas this one, he seems to have changed for whatever reason with the Lake Berryessa incident to go back to what he seemed comfortable with.
Yes, it's very, very dramatic departure of MO. The first two crimes were a couple's on Lover's Lanes. And then, he uses a gun, and now he's switching to a knife for Lake Berryessa. And also at Lake Berryessa, he had written on Brian Hartnell's car door. He was parked up on a taller road on Berryessa Knoxville Road. And this is one of the things tying some of the crimes together, because we can't do that with physical evidence. And a lot of people can make an argument, like Thomas Henry Horan, that all four crimes are not even related, but one of the things that does tie them together is that after Brian and Cecilia were stabbed, we think it was after they were stabbed. He could have actually done it before, but that would be a little risky. But he wrote on their car door the previous dates of the other murders, like Lake Herman Road. He wrote out that date. He put in numbers, he put 12, 20, 68, and then he wrote the dates of Blue Rock Springs murder, July 4th, he put 7, 4, 6, 9. And then the crime he had just committed there at Lake Berryessa, he actually wrote September as SCPT 27. And then he wrote under that by knife, meaning he's telling you now he used something different. He actually wrote by knife on the car door. And the handwriting was similar to the writing on some previous Zodiac letters that were already mailed into the local newspaper. So that's one of the things that does tie the crimes together, is that he referenced the two previous ones on the car door after he had committed the Lake Berryessa attack. But it was different. You know, it was daytime. He used a knife instead of a gun. And then he changes things up completely and he attacks a lone male. So now it's not a couple anymore. It's a lone male. And he wanted to make 100% sure that people knew that it was him by taking that shirt piece.
Yeah, that's the one that's always intrigued me the most, is the fact that he really wanted people to know he'd done that one, like you say, Drew, because it wasn't a couple. And I think this is one of the things about these particular cases, is obviously in the previous three events, two of the males who were attacked somehow survived. I mean, when you look at what happened to them and the injuries they received, it's amazing that anybody survived, never mind two of the men. But obviously all the women that he attacked did die. And that's always been a strange aspect to it, because it's remarkable when somebody suffers such trauma, either through a gun or a knife attack, Drew, that they're able to survive. And I think it probably, I can't even imagine what both of those two gentlemen spent the rest of their lives thinking about, especially with the late Berryessa one, because to be laid there and watch the person you're with be attacked must have been absolutely terrifying.
Horrifying. And then he was Brian Hartnell survives that, and the only thing he's ever participated in regarding Zodiac was the David Fincher film, which they had also made two accompanying documentaries with that film. One is called His Name is Arthur the Allen, which started it all for me personally. And another one called This is the Zodiac Speaking. And Brian was featured in that and helped with the recreation of that attack. So that must have been very difficult for him to do. But he did. And he said that the Lake Berryessa attack as depicted in the film was just almost exactly like it did happen in reality.
I suppose one of the other key aspects, along with everything else, because there's so many interesting points to this, that when you look at it as a whole, Drew, it's easy to see why it's been so intriguing for people. Because not only have we got this guy writing letters and the alleged Halloween card that he sends to Paul Avery, who and then the kind of strange relationship that Avery and the killer sort of have become sort of pen pals, it would seem.
Yes, secret pals. What the Zodiac called Avery his secret pal.
Yes, which I'm not sure any of us would want a pal like that, to be fair, Drew.
No, not at all.
Is that, you know, we've got these cryptograms that he would send in. We've got these letters. We've got the telephone calls. I think in every incident apart from the first one, he either writes or makes a phone call saying, I've done it.
Yes. Yes. There was a phone call after the Blue Rock Springs Park attack. He called into the Vallejo PD. A lady named Nancy Slover took that call, who's one of the few people that ever heard the Zodiac's voice outside of Brian Hartnell. And another police dispatcher who took a phone call after the attack at Lake Berryessa, he called into the Napa police because that was the presiding police department. So the killer knew that. He knew enough about the area to know that. It's not like he did Lake Berryessa and then called Vallejo PD. He knew the jurisdictional things going on. So he did. There was a phone call too. The Napa Police Department after the Lake Berryessa attack. It was actually very close to the police station itself. He called from a car wash and he left the phone off the hook. So there was actually people driving around to find that. And with the phone being off the hook, people would make noise or whatever when they got close. That's how they were able to find the payphone. And they did actually get what they considered very fresh fingerprints from the payphone that he used to call in after the Lake Berryessa attack in downtown Napa. And interestingly enough, none of the fingerprints ever collected in this crime, including some taken from Paul Stein's cab that had a lot of blood on it. None of the fingerprints ever matched each other. So none of the fingerprints taken from the cab matched the ones from the payphone in Napa. So that's still keeps people intrigued how there's no true physical evidence tying any two of these crimes together completely or at all. There's nothing that you can say 100% this gun was used at Lake Berryessa and Lake Herman Road, or this gun was used to kill Paul Stein, but we know it was also the one used at Lake Herman Road. There's none of that.
Mm.
So that opens the door for more speculation and theories.
Mm. Mm. I suppose as well, one of the things about this, and as you mentioned him earlier on, the BTK is a prime example of this rare phenomenon when it comes to serial killers, Drew, is that for some of them, they tend to continue until they either get caught or they die. BTK is one of the odd ones where he basically takes 10 years off and he has sort of spurts, as it were. And then his own stupidity and arrogance sees him get caught, which is still one of those.
It's his undoing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then again, that happens a lot with serial killers. You find often that, you know, and this is, I don't mean this disrespectfully in regards to the investigators dealing with these particular cases, often they make a mistake or they find themselves in a situation where they're caught through random acts. It happened here in the UK with the Yorkshire Ripper, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
He was caught completely by chance in a city by two officers not involved in the case whatsoever, which just shows you how these things happen. And so in regards to Zodiac, it's the fact that after Stein, it all seems to go quiet. Obviously, we've got numerous letters that start coming in, and I know there's been a lot of work in regards to the sort of analysis of these letters, and the vast majority of them are either copycats or people trying to perpetrate or extend a hoax, as it were, Drew.
Yeah, there's a lot of debate about the letters. Yeah. Lots of great researchers on it, like Richard Grinnell, I mentioned, another guy named Dreiser lives up in Canada with Richard. They've done some really good analysis into the letters, and there's no agreement. You know, there's still some disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Grinnell thinks a letter written in 1978 is authentic Zodiac, where a lot of people do not think that's authentic Zodiac. And that letter's interesting because that's the one they claim they've gotten a DNA sample from.
Mm.
It's the letter starts out with, this is the Zodiac. This is the Zodiac speaking, which he started a lot of his letters saying that. It says, I am back with you. And that letter is not considered to be authentic Zodiac, but there is a lot of debate about it. But the interesting thing is that the DNA sample that they have, the best one, comes from that letter, which is not even deemed to be genuine Zodiac. So that's how things are with this case. There's nothing that you can really, that's that tangible to help you solve it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I suppose as well, the fact that as you sort of started delving into this, was it Don's strange moving timeline and the fact that he was constantly putting forward Alan as the main suspect, was it that began to sort of flash a warning sign in regards to why you needed to dig into this? Because I think when you read your book, there are some amazing things that you've uncovered in regards to Chaney and where he was and who he knew, and it, almost like sliding doors moments, Drew, that he seems to be there or thereabouts with a lot of people involved in this case. As we mentioned earlier, Paul Avery is probably the most famous of the reporters that were involved in this particular case. There just seem to be so many things that when you start to look at them, surely you must be sitting there thinking, why has nobody looked at this guy properly before?
That's what I thought. That's what started for me, because I had heard of the case before. I had not even seen the movie yet of, you know, Zodiac by David Fincher, which was a very well-known major movie, you know, big release in the United States. Did well, you know, internationally, but I knew about the Zodiac case, but I never had even seen that movie. And a friend of mine kind of renewed my interest in the case because he was really into it. He was actually a big fan of Thomas Horan's theory, the Zodiac hoax theory. And that's what got me back into the case. And then I watched the documentary. His name was Arthur Lee Allen, which is, obviously focusing on Arthur Lee Allen being the prime suspect in the case. And that's the, you know, a long extended documentary format that Don Chaney is in, talking about Arthur Lee Allen and him telling him how he was going to go kill these couples on Lover's Lanes and basically confess. And I thought to myself, like, this guy is really strange, number one. You know, he kind of smiles slyly after everything he says. I just knew there was more going on with this guy. And considering that he's the one that brought forward the prime suspect, he needed to be looked at more. You know, there's got to be more to this guy that you know could be found out, which I did. I did a heavy dive. A lot of people would make comments under the video on YouTube saying that Cheney guy certainly seems, you know, pretty suspicious to me, you know. So everybody was in agreement that would watch the video, even if they didn't know the case that well. There's something up with this guy. You know, it's all so convenient. He was basically, you know, it's all because Ali told me. He told me he was going to do this, and everything was so convenient. He had an answer for everything. You know, anything that there was an abduction of a lady named Kathleen Johns who was with her daughter, and Don Cheney starts telling the story. Oh, he told me he would have this scheme where he would pull up to a woman and flag her over, telling her wheel's loose. And the woman would pull over, like being really grateful that the man told her that their car wheel was loose. And then the man would get out and actually make the wheel loose at that point. And then she'd drive off a little bit, and then the wheel would come off. Well, now she's vulnerable because her car's missing a wheel. And that's how he would gain an advantage on her. So everything that would come up, Don Cheney had an answer for it, as you know, Lee told me. And then from there, I just said, there's more going on with this guy. I find out, you mentioned Paul Avery, that he went to a small, tiny junior college in Bakersfield, California in 1953. So we're talking about way before Lake Herman Road, way before the Zodiac crimes, that Don Cheney's going to this tiny junior college in Bakersfield, where Don Cheney was born and raised in Bakersfield, California. It's kind of in the middle part of the state in the San Joaquin Valley. But no one knew that before. Paul Avery was attending Bakersfield Junior College at the same time as Don Cheney. And the total student body at the time was around 300. There's only two grades, 300 people total. So male students, roughly 150. He knew him. It was such a small world. Paul Avery was all over that campus. He w ran for class president of the freshman class. He lost. He wrote for the school newspaper called the Renegade Rip. He was a cheerleader. His friends were in a lot of the plays that were done at the time, which when they were both going there, they both but the school put on the production of the Mikado, which we know that the Zodiac was influenced by. So it was, for being a coincidence, that's a stunning coincidence that those two guys are at the same tiny junior college in 1953. And then when they're there, the school puts on a production of the Mikado, which we know the Zodiac made references to in two different letters. So that really caught my attention, because I knew at minimum that Don Cheney knew who Paul Avery was as early as 1953. Far away from San Francisco in a long time before. So I that circumstantially, that was a really big piece. And one thing that Zodiac wrote about a lot in his letters was having slaves. He believed, or at least we don't know if he believed it or he just wrote it to be interesting and creepy, but he talked about his victims being slaves in the afterlife. We don't know what culture that would be based on. It's kind of similar to the Viking culture, and that's been studied a lot in the Zodiac case, but he talked about these people that I killed are going to be my slaves. When I die, they will be my slaves in the afterlife. And he sometimes referred to that as paradise. And the Zodiac liked to misspell words for comedic effect, where you would have an alternate spelling. But if you read the word, it's spelled the same phonetically. And one of his favorites was paradise. He'd spell it Paradice. Very weird way to do it. And he didn't do this with every word. We later figured out that the Zodiac could spell. He just liked to do this, which is also interesting that Arthur Lee Allen, that's something they knew that Arthur Lee Allen did, was misspell words like that phonetically. But they knew Arthur Lee Allen did that before Lake Herman Road, which is a very interesting tie to Arthur Lee Allen. So it's like somebody must have known him to be doing this, because that's not a normal habit. But I also found out that Don Cheney had a relative with the last name Paradice. And of course, it was that spelling. Paradice. It's one of the most, I'm a genealogist. You know, I know the commonality of names really well. That's my background. And that name comes from England, and it is ultra, ultra rare. I mean, the regular spelling of Paradise is also a surname, but it's a tiny bit more common, but also very rare. But the Dice spelling was actually only one family that came from England. They migrated into Canada. And then some came into the U.S. and down to Denver, Colorado. And then every person with that name kind of came out of that specific family coming out of Denver, Colorado. So Don Cheney's grandfather, on his mother's side, his first cousin was a lady named Mary Martha Paradise, who married a well-known architect named Frank Paradise. So a very wealthy woman, because her husband was a successful architect, and she had also inherited a lot of money from an uncle who was really well-known and wealthy. And most of his children had died young for whatever reason, so she wound up getting the bulk of his estate. Hmm. So it all... you know, intents and purposes, that was probably Don Cheney's richest relative in his family tree. So it's pretty safe to say he had heard of her at some point. Don Cheney's mother's maiden name was Fryer. It had a different spelling, but it was pronounced Fryer. It was F-R-Y-R-E-A-R, but pronounced Fryer. And the Zodiac always talked about cruising on Fry Night. Zodiac would write F-R-Y in all caps, Fry Night, looking for more victims on Fry Night. So you have all these little, you know, things which you could just say are coincidences. But I think knowing Paul Avery that early, Fryer, Paradise, it's overwhelming. And even when you stack up all that circumstantial evidence, you could build a better case for Don Cheney than even Arthur Lee Allen. Mm. And then given it that Cheney knew Arthur Lee Allen, you have all of it right there.
I mean, the thing with the Mikado is stunning. Really, because this is the weird thing about this, because strangely enough, this is one of the things that sort of torpedoes Gary Stewart's belief as well. Because didn't Stewart yes. claim that his dad's favorite play was the Mikado, and he'd seen it in Japan, but it was banned in Japan, so he couldn't have seen it.
It was that's right. That's one of the things that really undermined him was that he claimed his father was in the Mikado, like you said, was exposed to it when he was in the military in Japan, and it was banned for many decades. Because they felt that it was making fun of them. You know, it was satire. Of course, it's an English play by Gilbert Sullivan. I think it came out in 1886. Mm. And it was banned for many decades there. And definitely during the time that Gary Stewart said his father was in Japan. So that shows you how little Gary knew the case. He didn't know it well because he would have known that. He probably didn't even realize that that was from two guys in England that had created that and not somebody in Japan. Another thing that really hurt Gary Stewart really bad was that he claimed that his father's handwriting was so similar to the Zodiac Killer's handwriting, because, of course, we have all these samples of Zodiac's handwriting. And one example that Gary Stewart put forward was on the marriage certificate for his mother when she married his father, Earl Van Best Jr. Well, later it was found out that the person that signed that was the minister, not his father. So I guess now the minister must be Zodiac, right? So it was just one catastrophe after the other with this guy, you know, namely those two, the Mikado faux pas and then the minister actually being the signer. Poor Gary.
Yes. Yeah, very strange. Well, it was one of those things. I remember watching it and I took a sharp intake of breath when that was revealed, and I thought, oh, I think I know where we're going here.
Yeah, at least they were, after they build up the case, and they kind of took it apart on him.
Yeah. Well, I think that should be, it's one of those things when you see these kind of programs, Drew, that I think that should be celebrated, because I know I've heard some people who were involved in that who were quite concerned how they were going to end up being portrayed. But I think everybody that's sort of been involved in it and used as a sort of talking head or an expert in regards to the case, the vast majority of people seem quite happy about their participation in that documentary series, I think.
Yeah, at least they balanced it out. And I understand. I've never read the book. I just know about the things that are in it. It was actually not a bad read because Susan Mustafa is a pretty good writer. I think they just felt the need to make it more interesting by tying Earl Van Best Jr. To being the Zodiac Killer. And there's really not even a shred of compelling evidence for him. Hmm. And what there was, which we found out later, is not even accurate, you know, between the Mikado and his handwriting. But one thing that is interesting about the Zodiac is what we believe was an Anglophile, which is somebody that's American but likes so many things that are English, because he quoted the Mikado. And then a big part of my theory is he was also a fan of Agatha Christie and Agatha Christie books. And that's one of the things that really stood out to me about Don Cheney, because he's talking about Arthur Lee Allen and in that documentary. And he says, you know, he said Lee didn't say it at the time, but I knew where he got his modus operandi from. And it was from this little book called The ABC Murders. And obviously that's a book by Agatha Christie. And when you read that, I think she wrote that in around 1934, 1935.
Yeah.
And when you read that book, it's got a lot of eerie coincidences to the Zodiac case. There's a lady that in the book that works at a breakfast restaurant that sounds a lot like Darlene Farren, the victim from Blue Rock Springs Park, who worked at she worked at the IHOP that was by Arthur Lee Allen's house. And that's so we know she knew Arthur Lee Allen because she worked at that restaurant that was literally 150 feet from Arthur Lee Allen's front door. We know that he ate at that restaurant with Don Cheney. So chances are beyond, you know, at least 100% that both Don and Arthur Lee Allen knew one of the victims from that restaurant. And at the time of her murder, she had left that restaurant. Her husband, Dean Farren, was still working there as a cook. But at the time of her murder, she was working at another breakfast restaurant called Terry's Waffle House in Vallejo. So there's that similarity there. And then you had in the ABC murders, this man that was wound up wanting to kill his brother because he was afraid his brother's wife was going to get his inheritance or something like that. But there's a series of four different sets of murders, and this brother's killing these other people just so when he winds up killing his own brother that it's harder for investigators to figure out who did it because they're looking at more than just one killing. They're looking at a set of killings, which is so reminiscent of the Zodiac. And also in the ABC murders, there's these taunting letters written to law enforcement or the detective in that case, which is Perot.
Yeah.
Very similar. And to what I really truly believe that the Zodiac killers were based on Agatha Christie's ABC murders. And then by a smaller extent, Jack the Ripper and all like the Mikado, Jack the Ripper, Agatha Christie. These are all things England in English. So I think he had some affinity for things in England.
That is a remarkable. I mean, sometimes I've heard people say too much of a coincidence isn't a coincidence, Drew, because for the similarities, because for anybody that loves crime literature, you know, Agatha Christie is one of the key authors of that particular field, and her books still continue to sell by the million, even into the modern era. You know, there's been numerous adaptations, TV and film. The books are never out of print. You know, you can go into any bookshop and find an Agatha Christie book. That one is not probably one you would suggest is that well known to people outside of the lovers of crime fiction, I would suggest, Drew. So
no, considered one of her better works, but yes, not one of the most well known. Correct.
Yeah.
It's kind of a obscure.
So for that to be, for the parallels to be so up front and center in regards to that is a very interesting connection that I don't think you can overlook, really. So, I mean, one of the other aspects of all this is that, and you touched on it a little earlier, is this Kathleen Johns incident, Drew, with the, you know, as you were saying about the car and the chap saying, oh, your wheel's coming off, and then he's actually loosened it, a car wheel flies off. There are some people that don't think that's got anything to do with it, but wasn't it the fact that she saw the witness sketch from the Stein case and said, that's the guy?
Yes. Yes. Then they took her into the police station at the Patterson Police Department. They had the famous sketch that was from the input of the kids, as I mentioned, the Robbins kids at Presidio Heights. And she said, that's him. That's the man. But she later would say a Zodiac suspect named Larry Kane was the attacker, who looks nothing like that sketch. So her credibility was really low. She was interviewed by Detective George Bauert, who had the case, the last official police officer or detective, police detective that had the case. He was a Vallejo PD detective, interviewed her, and he, you know, made the comment that she just didn't have any credibility, like she was doing this all for attention. She had a boyfriend at the time, and she was trying to get some attention from him by claiming she was a Zodiac victim. And I don't think that Kathleen Johns was a victim of the Zodiac. I do not believe Zodiac ever gave her a ride. They did find her car burned out. I think she probably did that on her own for attention. I think that's just one of the odd things that happens in one of these cases where people are trying to make everything connected to it because it's got so much popularity. I think that's something that she did. She passed away, but I would say 100% sure that she did not get apprehended by the Zodiac. But he did claim it.
Yeah.
He did claim it. He wrote a letter where he said, "I gave a rather interesting ride to a woman and her baby." So he was making reference to that without saying her name. The Zodiac never used names of victims ever. But he did try to take credit for these various crimes that I don't think he committed.
Hmm. Well, that's often the case, that these killers will often claim all kinds of cases. I know that there are some other well-known murderers, Drew, that have claimed to have taken victims that it was conclusively proved it couldn't have been them at all. And yet that still goes on. So he was very good at that, though, you would suggest, because it's not the only time he'd claimed responsibility for a case he had no real link to. I know there was another, was it Donna Lass? Was another
Donna Lass. Very interesting. Yeah, that was in the news lately because they finally were able to identify her skull by DNA analysis to that being hers. It was found in a place called Yuba Gap, California. Donna Lass disappeared, I think it was 1971, from Lake Tahoe, Nevada. And she's considered to be what we call a non-canonical Zodiac victim, like Sherry Jo Bates, that was murdered in 1966
yes.
in Riverside, California. But the last case did come up in the news because they were finally able to identify her skull, which I think was found in 1985, but they didn't know whose it was.
Mm.
But the technology finally came around and they were able to do the genetic genealogy tracing and were finally able to confirm that that was her skull found in Yuba Gap, California, probably maybe about an hour's drive from where she initially disappeared.
Mm. Do you think it's one of those that I know because he claimed at least three dozen, I believe, Drew.
Yes.
And there are some very odd cases from that particular period that still remain unsolved. Do you think there is a possibility that perhaps whoever this person was did do more? Or the fact that we know whoever this person was, they like to brag about things, even though they didn't use names. They always like to take the responsibility for what they wanted people to know they definitely did. And yet,
yes,
when we're talking about the Kathleen Johns case and Donna Lass, he specifically mentions them in correspondence to people, whereas some of these other unsolved cases from that particular period in around the same areas, he's never referred to them, has he?
No, that's very good insight into him. Very, very strange. I mean, he never, when he started talking about his collection of slaves for the afterlife, he starts with Lake Herman Road. He never said that, or made a reference to Sherry Jo Bates, which is probably the most well-known non-canonical Zodiac victim who was murdered Halloween Eve in 1966. He also took credit for that crime by saying, "I see the police have stumbled upon my Riverside activity." So by saying Riverside activity, he's basically taking credit for being the murder of Sherry Jo Bates, which, you know, some letters were written in after her murder. Some were later discovered to be hoaxed. They were able to do a genetic genealogy trace on some of the letters of that were sent after her murder. And they never, you know, Riverside police never announced who the person was, but they found this individual who was a white male, from what I know. And they were able to ascertain that he could not have been the killer of Bates and that he was also not the Zodiac. So that kind of lessened the possibility of her being a Zodiac victim when they found out that some of the correspondences was by a hoaxer. And then, you know, Donna Lass was came up as being a potential Zodiac crime because of a police detective named Harvey Hines, who was convinced it was a man named Larry Kane that killed Donna Lass and that he was also the Zodiac killer. That's how Lass gets on the radar from the work of a guy named Harvey Hines, who since passed away. But I do not think Larry Kane was obviously the Zodiac killer. It's still possible he was the killer of Donna Lass, but you could make an even better case that Ted Bundy killed Donna Lass because he had been in the area. And what we know of the Zodiac, at least for the canonical crimes, the Zodiac never abducted anyone. And we know that Donna Lass was abducted. She was last seen at an apartment complex, I believe, after work. And there was a phone call, too, after the Donna Lass abduction from someone claiming that she it was some excuse for her not going to be coming back to work. I can't remember what it was, like a family emergency. But it was an anonymous call, I believe, by a male that said she's had a family emergency, so she won't be in, as if to maybe buy time by whoever did it. So that was interesting as well. But I don't think there. But also, you know, he took credit for Donna Lass, seemingly through a correspondence called the Peek Through the Pines card, where it says around in the snow, and he's kind of alluding to where you could find a body. But like I said, he never mentions any of his victims or potential victims by name.
I suppose one of the other weird aspects of all this is obviously the situation that happened with Dave Toschke as well, Drew, because I know the film and the book don't really give you the full sort of truth to this particular incident. Was that there was obviously another letter arrived, I think in 78, was it?
Yes, 78.
That got everybody sort of hot under the collar again. And then for some reason, they decided that it must have been written by Dave Toschke, that he needed this case more than anything, and therefore the film certainly gives the impression that Toschke lost his job over it. But that didn't happen, did it? Because he was eventually cleared of writing it.
He was never officially cleared. I think that one of the top handwriting experts excluded him, but I think some could not. I can't remember. He was never convicted of it, or it was never proven to have been Toschke that wrote that letter. He did get caught for writing letters in another case he was involved in where he faked letters. So that happening really put him under the microscope for possibly faking the 1978 letter. I think it's highly possible he did write the 1978 letter, because it mentions Toschke in that letter. It says, "Tell that city pig Toschke I'm here, I've always been here," something along that effect. But that letter, you know, in its first two or three paragraphs, mentions Toschke by name. I think that's another reason why it, you know, because if he did fake that letter, of course he wants to bring attention to himself, but he writes something negative about himself. But I think the fact that the letter says that city pig Toschke, it kind of makes me believe that he did write it.
Because, yeah, I mean, other than Avery, and he always used to spell Avery's name wrong as well.
Right. Averly, A-B-E-R-L-Y. And that, you know, that's up for debate why he did that. I have my own opinion, but I don't know. Because at Bakersfield Junior College, Paul Avery was director of student assemblies, which has an L-Y in it. And that's how Don Cheney would have really known who he was, because Avery would get up in front of the whole student body every Friday and present an act from Los Angeles, comedians, actors, you know, really good presentations that you weren't required to go to, but you'd want to go to it because they always had something interesting. And of course, it's on campus, it's free. So that's my own little personal thing why he would have done it. But, you know, going back to Cheney, my whole thing with him is that he has the skills to be Zodiac from what we know. The Zodiac used a lot of mathematics and the ciphers. Don Cheney was a mechanical engineer. He had a keen understanding of mathematics. He had celestial navigation training in the Air Force, and a lot of the newer researchers like Stefan Nyberg, Sphere of the Cube, these guys are definitely finding things in the correspondences and what the Zodiac was trying to do, where he used judging by the stars, not astrology, but more the alignment of the planets. He was trying to line up these killings and the dates of these killings with the solstices. So he had a keen knowledge of the alignment of the planets, and that's something Don Cheney had. All the skills you would expect. He sent a letter to Tom Voight on graph paper. He wrote the letter to Tom on graph paper. Of course, that has the boxes on it. And we know the Zodiac used graph paper to do his ciphers because they were so neat and clean. He would use a light table so it would be lit so you could see the squares of the boxes. And then he'd put his regular piece of paper over that. So when he's drawing these symbols out by hand, they're perfectly aligned horizontal and vertically perfect. That's something he used. So Don had that, you know, he was as a mechanical engineer, he would have had all the insight to do things like that. Celestial navigation knowledge, been in the Air Force. The shoe print from Lake Berryessa was from a shoe they call a wing walker. That was mostly used by Air Force. Don Cheney was in the Air Force in the late 50s. That shoe was something they liked to use in the Air Force. It was a non-slip sole. Some of them had steel toes for if you dropped a heavy object on it, but that was primarily an Air Force shoe. and that was a size 10.5, a shoe print that was taken by Detective Hal Snook out of Napa. Just so many things line up with Chaney, but mostly going back to things he says, like ABC Murders, the little clues he leaves in his name was Arthur Lee Allen. You can tell he's enjoying the publicity. This is something that the Zodiac loved, was the publicity, the fear factor. Writing the letters and the ciphers meant more to him than the actual murders. It was far more important to have that name, the logo, and the fear. And doing the correspondences, the ciphers, was more important than the people lived or died. You know, like you mentioned, two of the males survived. I think it was, he didn't really care. I think it was more important to get the letters out and the ciphers out.
I mean, what, there is this other incident as well about him taking a polygraph test at some point, Drew, isn't there? Even though he knows he's doing this polygraph test for whatever reason. Didn't he not get drunk the night before, so he couldn't take it then?
Yes, famously, Don gets back on the radar with Detective George Bauer, who gets the case last, because by it was by attrition, and George says that because all the people that were investigating earlier had either retired or they passed away, like, you know, so many did, like Dave Toski, SFPD. But for Vallejo PD, George Bauer was the last detective that had the case in full. And George Bauer was a big believer that it was Arthur Lee Allen for many reasons. He started becoming convinced. He gave a photo lineup to Mike Mugeot, and Mike Mugeot famously picked Arthur Lee Allen out of that lineup. But I think Michael really couldn't remember by that point. He had a lifetime of drug abuse and a lot of crimes, a lot of credit card fraud and all that. But famously, Don Chaney made the comment when they heard that they were testing for DNA for Arthur Lee Allen. Don Chaney famously said that, oh, well, I would lick his stamps for him. I would lick Arthur Lee Allen's stamps because he didn't like the taste of stamps. And of course, that makes it look like Don Chaney's afraid of his own DNA showing up on some of the Zodiac correspondences. And he says this in his name was Arthur Lee Allen interview. So that's what made George Bauer also suspicious of Don Chaney. So he arranges for Don to take a lie detector test in Tacoma, Washington, because at that time Don has relocated to Benton City, Washington. I think Tacoma was probably about an hour and a half away. That was the nearest big city. Yeah. So they were making it convenient for Don Chaney. And Don Chaney knows this test is going to happen the next day. He knows the date. It's very important. You know, it's about the most famous serial killer of all time in America. And so he knows this is important. So he gets highly intoxicated the day before the scheduled polygraph test, as to be so hungover the day of the test that they have to postpone it. So he's obviously worried about something coming out in that polygraph. They eventually reschedule it, so he knows he can't do that trick again. And he retakes the test, and the results were that it was inconclusive. We don't know the questions asked, but it was never clear. They never said that he passed it. It was just inconclusive is the best they could come up with. So my theory is he's trying to beat it to some level and, you know, manage to muddy the waters just enough so it was inconclusive. So Don Chaney never passed the polygraph in relation to the Zodiac case.
I suppose as with everything in these kind of cases, Drew, as well, obviously the book's been out for a couple of years now. Has anything come to light to strengthen the argument for Chaney since the book? Because this often happens, and especially when we're dealing with a case like Zodiac, there's always something that seems to sort of pop up. As you say, every 6 months or so, we're told it's been solved again. So something else continues to strengthen your belief in this particular character?
Yes, you know, that's a great question. No one's ever asked that before. If anything, I'm a bigger believer now than I was back then. And obviously the theory in the book is out there. So people know it. They know this additional information. And he's just one of the suspects that you cannot get rid of. Also, like Arthur Lee Allen, you just cannot write him off. You know, he's like the bad, I can't remember the analogy, like the bad ex-husband that keeps coming around. You know, he's one of those suspects, and they are together. So I've not seen anything since the books come out that would make him seem less of a suspect in my mind. There's nothing that's been found out since that would point against it. Only more and more circumstantial evidence continues to build up. like I mentioned, the fact that some of these newer guys that are really smart, good researchers like Stefan Nyberg are seeing more clues in celestial navigation. You know, the different things that could have inspired the Zodiac to do what he did, what, you know, because he, even if he didn't believe in these things, he had to have had some knowledge of them to be able to write about them, like the Mikado. So this is obviously somebody that had a good love of not only literature, but also mathematics. And Don's a perfect combination of that. You know, through the book coming out, Don Cheney had two children that are still alive. I've never talked to them. The one being his daughter, who's very interested in the goings on with it, had contacted someone else that I knew of, pretty much trying to exonerate her father. And she was unable to do so. I know that because I know the person she was corresponding with. And the biggest problem that they had trying to, because this person actually agreed to help her try to exonerate her father. And the main thing that they were struggling with was the fact that he changed his timeline from January 1st, 1968 to January 1st, 1969, which is Don's Achilles heel. And the reason Don Cheney did that was because his initial story was that Arthur Lee Allen had been fired from teaching school at Valley Springs Elementary for inappropriately touching children, which is true.
Yeah,
that did happen. Problem is that didn't happen until March of 1968. So somebody, I don't know who, but years later, because the police did not even follow up on that. And they should have, but they didn't. Somebody else did years later, found out exactly when Arthur Lee Allen was terminated from Valley Springs, and it was March of 68. Well, problem is with Don's story is he's saying he was already fired by January 1st of 68, which is impossible.
Yeah.
So I think that in combination with some other things, he moved that timeline from 68 to 69. Another reason he did it probably was because he said, because I think he was worried about his DNA showing up, which it didn't. Actually, they tested Don Cheney's DNA and it did not match, but it did not match the 1978 letter, which we believe wasn't even written by Zodiac, could have been Dave Toski. And also the way that DNA sample was taken was by PCR testing, which is far more advanced. It needs to be done in a controlled setting in a lab, which it was not done that way. And when you find out about the conditions of the SFPD crime lab's DNA unit, it had multiple false convictions. The letters had been handled multiple times by people at San Francisco Police Department. They actually took a lot of the Zodiac letters home to their families to look at because there was so much. It's true. There was so much mystique around the case that these detectives would take the letters home and their family, like, look, you can hold one of the Zodiac's letters, you know, to their son or our wife or whoever. Yeah. So this stuff had been handled by everybody. And they wound up doing a show on Primetime Live here in the United States, a big TV show. And the producer of the show was very intrigued by the case, and he wanted to push it as hard as he can on this DNA angle to try to get an answer like they did with the Gold State Killer. And I think that was in 2001. It was a long time ago already. And when they were testing these letters, they couldn't get a good profile from the letters they had at SFPD. So when they were filming the show before it was actually even ready to be put on, suddenly three more letters showed up. And they were from a detective that had had them at his personal home. They weren't even kept where they should have been. So one of those was the 78 letter that was kind of found in a stack of mail at the San Francisco Chronicle. But the three additional letters for testing were at this man's home. So anyone had touched them. There could be no confidence in anything DNA-wise with the Zodiac, unfortunately, particularly when it comes to SFPD. Vallejo police had their own letters that were sent to the Vallejo Times Herald. Those wound up being in the possession of the Vallejo Police Department. So they had their own letters separate from the SFPD, and those were sent away for advanced DNA testing about 4 years ago now. And nothing was ever said of them until it leaked that they did get a DNA profile from one of the letters that was in their possession. And it was somebody that could not have been the Zodiac. So there was all this speculation. Well, what could that be? Could it have been an African-American? Could it have been a female? And then it later did come out that it was a profile of a female. So who knows if that's somebody that was connected to any suspect or not. But the bottom line is they were unsuccessful. And the only other physical evidence were some plastic bindings that were left at Lake Berryessa that the Zodiac had used to tie up Brian and Cecilia. And those had been barehanded. So I by many people over the years. So I think there's almost no possibility of getting a touch DNA or anything from those. So it's unfortunate that, that we may not ever get an answer definitively who the Zodiac was.
Well, it just baffles me. I think it's one of those things we look back, Drew, at how police forensic work used to be done. And I think we can sometimes presume that the modern methods, officers in the past were still, you know, were meticulous with it. But we know it's not just this particular case. There are loads of cases. As you were talking there, I was thinking of a murder case here in the UK where one of the key pieces of evidence was a shovel and it disappeared. They didn't know where it had gone. And it ended up turning up in one of the police officers' homes. He'd taken it home to use.
Yeah, it wasn't even the mystique of it. He just took it home to use as his personal stubble. Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's so unfortunate, but true, that that's just horribly displayed. We have the same thing in the D.B. Cooper case, because the really only piece of evidence in the D.B. Cooper case was his necktie. It was a clip-on JCPenney tie, very cheap, that he had left on board the aircraft. And, you know, that had been subject to DNA testing by using a little miniature vacuum looking thing that would vacuum up the particles and the things they found. But the problem is that that tie was so infamous through the years when the FBI, well, they still have it, but people would wear it to parties that the FBI had. They had shipped that tie by mail to various JCPenney stores to see if anybody recognized that exact tie. It had been, I mean, handed with bare hands over and over. It had so much mystique about it. Like it was just, it's too contaminated to ever really give anything of use.
I suppose before I let you leave, Drew, I mean, obviously you've covered Zodiac. You've also written a brilliant book about the D.B. Cooper, which is another case, which is for me is very similar to the Zodiac in regards to the mystique and the magic that it seems to still captivate people, obviously these days. You know, famously they even have a festival now where people dress up as D.B. Cooper to celebrate.
Yeah, they have
this.
Cooper, now it's called CooperCon every year. A guy named Eric Ulis puts that on. It's either held in Portland or last year it was in Seattle. Mm. So yeah, people dress up and it's a real big deal.
And that's one that, you know, so many people. Once again, you've got numerous people put forward to it. There are people that think of one particular person due to one particular TV show. And yet that one's the same. So so for you then, Drew, after tackling Zodiac and D.B. Cooper, and you've also looked into the Yuma 5, which is another incredible case. What mystery's next? Where are you going to go?
You know, I don't know. I have a lot of fascination with various missing persons cases, like, you know, the missing 411 profiled by a guy named David Politis, the researcher. Yes. But there are certain cases of those that I want to tie together that have so many similarities. There was a geologist that went missing named Daniel Robinson, whose father's real involved in trying to find out what happened to him, where he disappeared in the middle of Arizona, where he was doing some geology work. And they found his Jeep and they found all his personal effects in this Jeep that had been wrecked, but no sign of him. You know, they found the wallet, cell phone, everything else, but they've never been able to find any remains from him or anything else. But it's so interesting that that his clothes were strewn about and that all his personal stuff was there. Because if you walked away and you were still alive, why would you leave your cell phone and these kind of personal effects? Very similar case happened to a guy named Jason Landry that's from not far from where I am in Texas, who went missing after leaving his college, driving back to the Houston, Texas area. They found his car in this small town on a remote road where his clothing was strewn about. They found his cell phone. The car had been wrecked, but not too bad to where he would have been injured. It's very similar to Robinson's case. And I don't know what's going on there, but I think there's something going on that ties these things together. Like, I don't know what, but that fascinates me. So many of these guys, and they're always around that same age range.
Yeah.
They're always from like 18 to early 20s, and they're usually male. No really preference to race, but they leave behind their clothing strewn about, personal effects, and they're never seen again. There's another case from a guy named Terrence Woods Jr. who went missing in the middle of Oregon filming a TV show. He was on a production crew where he, all you know, he's acting kind of bizarrely before his disappearance, but it was broad daylight. He's working on the show. He drops his handheld radio and he sprints into the wilderness. And he was no runner. He was flat-footed, according to his father, but he just sprints into the wilderness, never to be seen again. And he was in that age range. He leaves behind all his personal things again. So I'm interested in cases like that and tying them together because I think there's a link.
Fascinating. I mean, some of those, like you say, the circumstances and the evidence that's left behind, they just make you scratch your head, Drew, because they don't make any sense.
No sense at all. And one thing is, people that report on them say that the people were acting strangely before their disappearance. Mm-hmm. You know, that was out of character for them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, not if a suicide or whatever, you don't need to run into the wilderness.
No.
It's like something comes over them and they disappear.
Yeah. Oh, well, I look forward to whatever you've got planned in regards to those particular cases. So, Drew, where can everybody find your YouTube channel and get a hold of a copy of your marvelous collection of books so far?
All my books are on Amazon. I also have a website, drewbeesonbooks.com. And then, like you mentioned, my YouTube channel. If you just type in the Zodcast, Zodcast, that's my weekly Zodiac Killer show. And then I have a lot of other things on that channel, missing people that would, you know, I just mentioned. I have probably a video on each one of them. Hmm. And also Yuba County 5 that you mentioned. And of course, a lot of DB Cooper stuff as well.
Brilliant. Well, Drew, thank you once again for taking the time and your excellent expertise in regards to this particular case. It's been fascinating to spend some time with you and dive into this. So thank you again, and I hopefully look forward to the chance to speak to you in future.
You too, Paul. Really enjoyed it.